So good morning, welcome. I'm Dr. Sean Oakes. It's good to see you. Really a pleasure to be here this morning. We'll start with some practice, sitting in meditation together, a cushion or chair, any posture that's comfortable for you. For folks sitting on the floor on cushions, it's helpful to sit on enough elevation to bring the creases of your hips level with or higher than your knees, so sitting up tall. If you're taking back support on a wall or a back jack, then that doesn't count. You don't need to sit higher if you're doing that. That takes care of that. The point of sitting a bit higher than the knees is that it allows the back to be relaxed while you sit up. Once you find a posture where the lower body is settled and easeful, the marker, in a way, one of the things that we look for in that is that the belly can relax, the low back can relax, the upper body can relax. So taking a moment to just find your way into that posture. If you're in a chair, you can use the back of the chair to lean back. If you don't need that, sitting on the front edge of the chair can feel more upright, and they just have a slightly different tone in the body. Do whichever is most available for your body and most comfortable, most pleasurable. And in general today, I'll teach you right away the most secret, powerful of the yogas that we will use as our underlying principle today, which is do things that feel good. And you laugh because you've been taught something else. But you've been taught in a way that is incomplete if you don't understand yet that pleasure is the pathway to liberation in all of the major traditions. So do what feels good. Sit in a way that's comfortable, that's easeful. Some folks' bodies prefer to be lying down. Some folks' bodies prefer to be standing up, sitting on any kind of support. We're coming together on a beautiful spring day. This day is offered as part of the ongoing investigation in our lineages of Dharma, of Buddhism and yoga, of many forms that are arising in the West, in the European and American traditions, really over the past couple of centuries, but very prominently in the last several decades. Part of this transmission is the deep challenge for folks being exposed to the traditions of another culture, to try to understand them, to try to respect them, to try to learn from them in ways that are helpful, harmonious, in ways that actually work to liberate, in ways that that also serve and are respectful to the challenges of our world now. So we arrive here in the midst of all that. We also arrive here in the midst of the enormous cultural unfolding of our time, where as a world, in many, many different ways, we are grappling with the effects of a very difficult couple of centuries. Centuries in which slavery and indigenous genocide were central to unfolding life on Earth, culminating in the huge and kind of existentially challenging process of climate emergency that's unfolding right now. At the same time, we are in a period where contact between people and cultures, contact between peoples who up until really our lifetimes, in many ways, were much more rarely in contact with each other. And so contact gives rise to complexity. And the topic today is complexity in a certain way. More deeply, the topic is liberation, healing, what to do, what can we do now on the planet as it is now. And so we're going to spend the day going way back in time, telling some stories, doing some practices, which we'll start with here. I come to this practice 25 or so, depending on how you count the starting moment, into a relationship with both the Buddhist and Hindu wings of the yogic tradition. In Buddhism, I began with Rinzai Zen in the tradition of Joshu Sasaki, and later Theravada Buddhism in the tradition of insight meditation here at Spirit Rock with Jack Kornfield, my mentor. At the same time, I began in postural yoga practice, initially with a teacher from the Kripalu tradition, a student of Amrit Desai, a student of Kripalavananda, that lineage. But very shortly was in Ashtanga, the tradition of Patabi Joyce, and his teacher, Sri Krishnamacharya from Mysore. And I practiced a vigorous free-form vinyasa descended from Ashtanga for many years and taught that for many years. Encountering more recently the Tibetan or Vajrayana forms of Hatha Yoga, physical yoga practice, we'll talk about a little bit this afternoon. And practicing, just beginning to study those forms now in some more depth. We'll talk some about their history. I'm also an adopted mixed race California suburban kid. Yeah, you too. Turkeys, every one of us. Did you know the turkey almost was voted America's national bird? And then someone in the founding fathers, you know, swung in and was like, no, the bald eagle. We should have this, like, you know, mountainous scavenger who feeds on dead corpses rather than, you know, this, like, majestic, ground-dwelling, fecund, beautiful, gobbling bird. Maybe once we figure out the Green New Deal and saving the planet from the bad guys, we can change the national bird back to what it should have been. I partly come to the practice of having conversations about Buddhism and yoga, its relationship, and our history from the position of that many of us have inhabited at different times, starting as a faithful adherent to things that I was taught by Western teachers. Mindfulness is this. It will save you. You know, postures, asana, yoga is this, it will save you. Neither of those are true. Sorry. Go home now. Mindfulness will not save you. Postures will not save you. They might help along the way. We'll get to that. But I started off, you know, hearing these messages and practicing vigorously. And at some point, I think what happened was enough of us for a couple of generations did that enough that we got through a couple of layers of like, wow, this is great. This helps so much in my like kind of neurotic life. We started looking around and be like, what are we really doing here? And then, of course, it helped us out so much. We actually started having conversations with people, which was less available before. And we found out that we know far less about these traditions and their origins than we thought we did. As converts often are like that. And then that the process of the transmission of these beautiful, life-changing teachings and methods was not uncomplicated and actually had caused quite a bit of pain over the last century or two. And then some of us started to say, wait a minute, the stuff I was taught is neither as helpful as I was told it was going to be, nor as harmless. And actually, maybe it wasn't gifted to me at all. What do I do about that? At one point, early in this conversation, I thought, maybe I would do more good in the Western world as an Episcopal. Maybe I should go to seminary and, take up that wing of Christianity that said that God and Christ are subtle, immaterial, beyond form and distinction, inseparable from your own soul, really. Speak from that place. And I ended up not doing it yet. I told a student this a couple weeks ago, so I'll just tell you now that it's in a very public way, I'll tell you. When I was reflecting on this, I flashed back to the moment when I was 9, where my parents, we were Catholic, but it was the 70s, so we were under the influence of kind of the early Pentecostal evangelical movement, liberal Catholics in the 70s, God bless them, thinking outside the box. The Catholic Church had not imploded yet. It was still doing what would cause it to implode. My folks actually walked me through at 9, basically a classic born-again experience, where I, accepted Christ as my Savior, and I cried a lot. I don't think I really knew it was happening. I think that's the point of that kind of thing. And then I promptly forgot about it, and I was a grumpy teenager, and that was fine. Failed to get confirmed. Kept dropping out. And I dropped out all the way to a monastery in the mountains of New Mexico that used to have been a Catholic church. There was still a stain on the wall of the meditation hall where the cross had been for 40, 50 years, and they took it down. But, it discolored the wall. Hashtag not a metaphor. And the Buddhists had bought it because there were hot springs behind it. My Zen master had said, like, sure, I'll, buy a center in the mountains as long as there's hot springs. So they got hot springs. Very nice place to practice. And I ended up there, shaved head, black robe, long autumn mountain retreat. And I started to restitch something of like, something was reminding me about who I am, who I might be, who I think I might be. And it started to weave together. The Catholic Church wasn't able to show me anything really about who I might really be. The Buddhists were just better at that, the way it came over. That's not inseparable from trauma. Like, if my culture and the church were not traumatized, maybe it could have done so. Maybe in a healthier form, the church would have kept me. Maybe either of us in a healthier form, we would have stayed in that relationship. But we broke up. It was a good breakup. 20 years later, I was like, should I still be Catholic? At this point, I was like, no, not Catholic, but, you know, it's like, you want to be able to have my family now, so no Catholics, but I could be an Episcopal. And I thought, like, what would stop me from doing that? Or maybe the better question was, what would be the right way to do that? And I was like, okay, I would do it if it was real. Like, if I had the call. If I really, you know, Saul of Tarsus, like, he's on his horse, he's headed somewhere, boom, blinding light off the horse, onto the floor. Wow. You know? And so, I never told this story publicly, but here I am. I want to tell you, partly because I want to tell you who I am to tell this story to you today. I said one night in ritual, I said, okay, Jesus, we have a old relationship, you know. I called up my old flame. Basically, it's okay. If you want me back, right? It was that conversation. I was like, if you want me back, you have to tell me in a way that is undeniable, like impervious to doubt. You knock me off my horse, and I'll figure out what to do with that. Until then, this is my home team. So, here I am. It's my home team. Part of that has been the process of doing something in a certain way different than my teachers here did. One of the things I'm doing right now is I'm mentoring for my mentor, Jack Kornfield, who founded this beautiful, amazing Dharma field here, Spirit Rock, in a massive online mindfulness training course, 1,400 people studying to teach the basic practices of mindfulness out in the world. Part of what Jack has done that is brilliant and complex is, and many teachers of his generation have worked to bring the teachings of Buddhism that they learned from their Asian teachers, from Ajahn Chah, from Upandita and Mahasi Sayadaw, from Dipa Ma, from Ajahn Buddhadasa, to European and American secular communities in a way that de-emphasizes their religious aspect, the ritual aspects, the devotional aspects, the belief and faith aspects particularly, right? And the result of that has been incredible, right? Like mindfulness all over the place on the cover of Time magazine, right? Although it still seems, if you take Time magazine as an example, it still seems that mostly young, pretty white women are the only ones meditating. But and then middle-aged guys in suits. So Dan Harris, his 10% happier thing, right? Mindfulness can help you be 10% happier. I just have to say that the Buddha categorically said that settling for less than 100% is stupid. He's like, why would you do that? The Dharma leads you all the way to full liberation. But I will also say that he said the Dharma is good in the beginning, the middle, and the end, which means it's good in the beginning, which means if you get only a little bit, it's good. So, you know, bows to Dan Harris for spreading the Dharma. And it's really only marketing. A lot of people who do that practice will get way more than 10%. It's nice to have a low bar. You know you succeeded. You're already 10% happier. Check. But the same thing happened in yoga. You know, folks came over, and in the early generations of yoga in America, you know, it was completely interwoven with devotional practice, with meditation practice. Ram Dass was teaching postures and meditation and singing to Krishna and Hanuman, you know, and Shiva. And when I started in Ashtanga, we were still, you know, chanting to Patanjali at the beginning of every class, bowing to an altar with a guru on it who has now been fully deposed, which is a good thing, for profound misconduct. And that's also, every layer of this is complicated. I know we were going to meditate, but hey, we'll get there. When I started, even in free-form San Francisco vinyasa class, you know, 95% exercise, good exercise, let me tell you, with a couple of qualifications, we were still, you know, doing almost the whole thing to soundtracks of chanting of mantras, and you know, or to just silence, but chanting in the beginning and end of class. You know, singing Sri Ram, Jaya Jaya Ram. You know, singing Om Namah Shivaya. And I almost nobody now doing that in yoga class. The same shift in the mind of like, oh, this method helps. Let's drop the culture. Kind of let go of Indian culture, let go of the Hinduness in yoga. There's a whole conversation going on right now, you know, in the broader kind of activist yoga community, trying to work and push against Hindu phobia in the broader yoga community. And you might wonder, especially if asana practice is your primary practice, you might notice if you ever think about describing what the lineage that you do, the practice that you do of postures, and prefer the term yogic over the term Hindu. And to wonder about that. Or if we like mindfulness, why do folks really prefer the term mindfulness over the term, you know, Buddhist? And partly a part of this is in this amazing translation process, right? Translating the methods and techniques that work so beautifully to bring healing to the heart and mind and open ourselves to deeper truths, translating them into, you know, a non-religious culture, into a science-based culture, translating them through scientific studies and through, you know, this is really about focused attention. All of that's good. The postures are good for health mostly. That's good. You know, they help focus the mind. That's good. And there's been so much changed. And I think the underlying impulse for a day like today is, in my generation, and I'm now really second generation from Asian teachers, really first in a certain way. I've had some Asian teachers. I was a monk in Burma for a short while. But mostly my teachers have been Westerners whose teachers were Asian teachers. So there's I think of it as a kind of generational pendulum. Many of my teachers went to Asia, learned these profound practices in their religious context, came back here and changed them into a context that fit this culture. They did the process of translation. So now I grew up here, you know, once I came here to Spirit Rocks, I learned mindfulness, I learned meditation. I did many long retreats here, up the hill there. I tried to do the 2-month retreat every year for a while. Really like retreat. It's not everybody's thing. I like it a lot. Introvert practice. I didn't realize until we went to Burma that we kind of invented that form. Like, you don't get to do a silent retreat like that in Burma. You know, I was in it. Monastery, there's festivals, there's people all over the place, there's novices running around studying things, chanting loudly every morning, there's construction going on. It's kind of right in town, so right out the back window of the meditation hall was this big neighborhood. At some point I'm meditating, doing profound traditional Burmese vipassana, monk robes. I've done it, I did the whole thing. I became a Buddhist monk, and I start hearing like, what is that sound? What is that sound? I'm like, oh, somebody's practicing the clarinet. Couple hours go by. I'm like, what? They've been doing it every day. I'm like, what? I sort of recognize that. Like, synapses are connecting. Burma's clarinet. I'm like, oh, somebody's learning to play Madonna's Like a Virgin on the clarinet in this neighborhood in Burma behind my monastery. And I'm like, come on. I was trying to escape to the pristine, perfect Orient. Which is, of course, racist and appropriative. Like, what did I think I was doing? I was trying to go, essentially, to, you know, the mythical land where they train sorcerers. So I saw Endgame last night. Did anyone see opening night? I am the only one in here who knows who died. Exactly. So, first of all, I know that I'm at Spirit Rock. How many people here are not even tracking the Marvel comic book movies? Brilliant, you guys. How many people are? Okay. For you guys, I will not reveal any spoilers. My wife and I went on opening night. People were dressed like superheroes. You know. So, this is the gesture that that Doctor Strange makes. He went to Tibet and like learned all this magic from Tilda Swinton, which is a weird choice for Tibetan master. She's very, very white, very bald. I liked her better in Orlando. That's the fantasy. And that was in a certain way always the fantasy. 100 years, 150 years. This is the fantasy called Orientalism. Like, oh, there's this like pristine, perfect, flawless, you know, ethical, powerful people over there in the Himalayas, over there in Asia. Taoist sages, Chinese Zen masters, Japanese Zen masters, you know. Part of this story is the topic for the day, which is that we can't understand the history without understanding our own history. How did you come to these practices? Why are you here? Why aren't you still Catholic or Jewish? And I'm speaking to the white people there. So if you are from an Asian culture, and there are some folks here, it's kind of a different question. It's a very different question. You know, how did you get here? What about the stories of immigration and culture that brought you here? You know, if you're Japanese, was your family in the internment camps? If you're Indian, you know, who are you from? Like, are you Shaiva? Are you Vaishnava? Are you a Buddhist, Christian, Jain? You know, it's so much more rich and complex to engage with cultures I'm not sure what the right medicine is here. Part of it is with as much information as possible. That's some of the avenue that I took. When I was really like, oh, I have no idea what we're doing here. Start reading. That's always been my thing. I'm like, okay, start reading. So I start reading and reading and reading and reading and reading. And talk to people. I went and got a doctorate. And I was like, I've got to figure this out. I didn't figure it out. And a doctorate. What we're going to do today is we're going to try on some practices from several layers of the South Asian Indian yogic traditions, really specifically from the a couple of the Buddhist lineages and a couple of the Hindu lineages. In the Hindu, primarily the Shaiva line. In the Buddhist, we'll start with the Theravadan line and move into the Vajrayana line in the afternoon, the tantric material that's shared by both. And part of what we want to figure out is the perception that has arisen here in the globalized system, in a very popularized way, is that yoga is postures and Buddhism does meditation. And now I just want to sort of give you the punchline of the whole day, which is that that's not true. And that the Buddhist systems absolutely do postures and the yogic systems absolutely do meditation. And that for nearly their entire history, the two streams constantly interwove with some very specific geopolitical ruptures, particularly when Buddhism was destroyed in India around the 12th century. And that was the single major split, where from that point the two systems developed separately because they were separated by conquest, really by the Mughal Empire in India, which also ended Indian Tantra as a broadly practiced religious form. But up until that point, which is like for the whole first half of their history, the systems were tight siblings, in conversation all the time, sharing texts, sharing teachings, sharing practices. So for the first half of today, we'll look at the early part of that history, where they interweave constantly. In the second part of the day, we'll look at some of what happened after they split, where essentially they split in a way where they had the same seed material. The seed material of Hatha Yoga had already been established before that split. And so Hatha Yoga then, and I'll define that term later on, developed essentially in parallel in Tibet and in India, what's now India. And so, and then, you know, of course, you know, they were separated by geopolitics, but kept having conversations. And part of the result of the modern period is that they got back in touch. They were like, hey, old friend, wow, you're doing this. That's cool. We'll do that. You know, wow, you're doing this. Well, and now there are lineages that have re-merged the ancient split, and that's really interesting. So we'll get into some of that. Yeah? So there's a little bit of background. That's who I am. That is what, where, that's the ferment that this day comes from. The point of speaking this way again is to orient us. And there's one more piece of orientation that that we want to do here, which is just to let yourselves look around and see both who's here, but also see out the windows and see where you are. Is anyone here on the Spirit Rock land for the first time today? Welcome, a handful of y'all. Is anyone here from who lives in a like more than 100 miles from here? Like you're in from far away. Welcome to a handful of y'all. All right, welcome to Northern California. Anyone from out of state, like further away, further. Brilliant. Further people. Cool. You can't move here. It's too expensive, but it's nice to have you visit. So look out the windows for a moment. See the green hills, the trees, the blue sky. The trees of this land are the coast live oak and the tan oak, the redwood, the bay laurel with its incredible leaves that we put in our soups, the manzanita, the little apple, pines and firs, coast cypress out toward the ocean that way. For at least 5,000 years before the Spanish arrived here, this land was tended and not so much lived on, but lived and breathed in the form known as the Ohlone culture, the Coast Miwok, a little bit north of here into Sonoma, the Pomo cultures. Five 5,000 years of more or less uninterrupted living in this land in a way that didn't deplete it, that didn't tax it. People and their families and their songs and dances unfolding. Generation after generation after generation, you know, in what we call indigenous, which really just means like the stories and the heart and the soul of a people are of that land. Like the creation myths are, we are of this place. My creation myth is not that. My creation myth is I'm from a place way the heck over there. A different valley of rivers. I've never been to the Tigris and the Euphrates. That's where I was told I was from. Right? That's what my religion told us I was from. What is that place? Me and Jack Kornfield got arrested today trying... Today, not today. Sorry. I meant to say together. Me and Jack got arrested together trying to stop the United States from invading Iraq. It didn't work. Biggest protest in the history of the world at that time. I think the Women's March exceeded it. Good going. That was excellent. But at the time, that was the biggest global peace march, saying to the United States, don't invade this country. And among the many, 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 many things I might say about that, I might say that that's where the Tigris and the Euphrates are. Like the mythical homeland of these people who would then invade. And as far as I can tell, I care not a bit about that land and those rivers. And as far as I can tell, not care very much for this land and these rivers. So we begin our day here acknowledging, bowing to, and I don't want to make this easy, understanding that we are on land that was tended well for longer than is we can almost imagine, many of us. And it took 50 years from the arrival of the Spanish mission system, from 1776 to about 1835, for 99% of the indigenous residents of California to be living on mission land. We have to come out of denial around what is happening. And studying the ancient history of another culture, for those for whom this is not, that is, the topic of today is not your culture, is part of this. And so now, more and more, and this is a thing that my generation is bringing in and learning from the indigenous elders that are still here, to do, and learning from our own study, and learning, I want to say, from a beautiful ancient emotion that I want to call honor, but I could also call shame. And I want to say that it is honorable in an ancient cultural way to be ashamed of the harm caused by your own ancestors and to desire in the depth of your heart to do right with what we have now. And that's the same thing I want to try to do today in untangling some of the threads of these practices. So that we can go forward in a way that is more liberated for everyone here. The turkeys and the bobcats and the mountain lions and the Ohlone who are regathering. Reassembling, raising money in the East Bay for a land base. Like, it's kind of really simple. You can make reparations, right? 200 years is not that long in the scope of 5,000. And that's, in a way, the same thing I want to say about yoga. It's like, what if the last couple hundred years has been rough globally, and that we now, some of us, probably people younger than most of us, will do most of the work to make that change? So, here we are on beautiful land well tended for a long time. Begin our meditation taking a moment to just let that land in the way that we use the word land, meaning let it settle inside, let it be in us. And then, and I know this is a lot already, welcome, to let ourselves land. And you might still do this with eyes open, just knowing where you are. Knowing who you are, who your family is, who our stories are. What brought us to this continent? Was it by force? Was it fleeing? Was it creativity and a search for something? Landing in who we are, who we come from, where we come from. The religions and cultures of our birth, and that which we have converted to. And just notice how it feels. Notice what the body is like as we kind of, as I start by just bringing these threads in and saying, in a way, here we are now. These bodies now. This history now. So here's a gesture that I learned from my teachers in a form called Authentic Movement, which is a postmodern movement-based inquiry form. And the form is to indicate the closure of a piece of work by touching both palms to the ground. And I want to combine it with a full breath. So whatever you've been feeling or working with as we've been doing this opening investigation, go ahead and take a full breath and open your arms without bonking somebody next to you. And then exhaling, just touch down in whatever way. That could be your knees, it could be the floor, it doesn't have to be the floor, but just directing your energy down, just landing. If you're in chairs, knees is good, pushing your feet into the floor, whatever works. And then letting that go. And you might just shake it off a little bit, and now we will indeed sit for a short bit.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.